Transparency's labor and other misapprehension that the title of the conference was emergence of the thermodynamic limit. So I want to begin by apologizing. I'm not going to use, although I may mention, the word emergence. There's just too many things that might mean I'm in no position to be responsible for using correctly. So what I want to do instead is raise the following kind of question. I want to raise it about quantum statistical mechanics and thermodynamics. By now, you know the game. There's a system, thermodynamic systems, they have bulk properties that stand to one another in interesting relationships. The game of statistical mechanics is to try to, in some sense, forge an understanding of the bulk behavior of the system by offering a microphysical model of it. Model it as a collection of microsystems. Quantum statistical mechanics, the physics of the microsystems is quantum. And then, in various fraud ways you can discover it, you try to understand thermodynamics. What it is to take the thermodynamic limit of quantum statistical mechanics, for the purposes of the question I want to address, is play the same game, do some quantum statistical mechanics, but let the number of microsystems you're positing and the volume they occupy go to infinity. Very, 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 very big cup of coffee. So the question I want to ask is, when you go to the thermodynamic limit, does anything noteworthy happen? Anything noteworthy, particularly of a sort that people who were inclined to use the word emergence would use mm-hmm. to describe? And the follow-up question, which I probably won't get you, time constraints, this kind of a rant, I might have time to do at the end, but I doubt it. Should those interested in foundational matters pay the thermodynamic limit any mind? There's an argument with Artie, Jessica talked about that. No, because obviously my cup of coffee is fire. So luminaries like Jeremy Butterfield, Greg Callender, John Herman have sort of deflationary answers to these questions.
Was that anything
you didn't hear, or was it the vulgar?
I shouldn't have said anything.
Okay, we can just turn it off and try the other one. Yeah, that's brighter.
Thank you.
Now we can turn off the sun.
I know. Well, at least we got the overhead off. So a little better.
Pache, Jeremy, I'm going to try to say something sort of interesting happens. Pache, Craig, and John who say, nobody should be interested in that. I'm going to say, I don't know whether they should be interested in throwing it, but neither do they. So to sharpen up the question and the answer, I'm going to try to argue sort of. I'm going to, so there's this book, I even wrote about Kant's first critique, the title of the book is What is the Thing? There's this kind of very continentally question you can ask, what is the concept of object? In spite of it sounding continental, it's a question you can understand theories of physics as answering. Theories of physics, they don't purport to give you an account of the concept of object in general, but there is a way in which they tell you what it is to be the kind of object they treat, what it is to be the kind of physical system they're about. And here, my story about the sort of answer they give to the what is the thing, what is the concept of object according to me is going to resonate with things that Peter and Jessica said. I'm going to suggest, and this is, where'd she go? Yes, I am. He said this as well in one of her books. I'm going to suggest the way in which a theory of physics equips the kinds of physical systems it talks about with an account of what it is to be a physical system is by equipping those systems with a type of state space. So here's some examples. You have classical particle, make life simple, say it's moving in one linear dimension. Its state space is going to be a two-dimensional plane parameterized by pairs of real numbers, one of which you can think of as a momentum, the other is the position of the system. Those parameters stand to one another in interesting functional relationships. The kinetic energy of a particle you can define in terms of the momentum. You can ratchet the interesting functional relationships. Those magnitudes stand to one another into an account of how they change over time. And my suggestion is that's the concept of classical logic, or that's a large part of the concept of classical logic. You supply it, the theory supplies it, and this is the kind of state it has. These are the kind of magnitudes that pertain to individually distinguish between the states. These are the functional nonic relationships that obtain between those magnitudes. A very different kind of object is a quantum object, a spin one half system, an electron. Not surprisingly, according to this account of what it is for a physical theory to tell you what a thing is, a quantum object like a spin one half system has a very different kind of state space. A two-dimensional vector space, a complex-dimensional vector space called, two-dimensional vector space. Its states are vectors of the space. The kinds of physical magnitudes that pertain to it correspond to operators on the space, those physical magnitudes stand to one another in a characteristic kind of set of functional relationships called canonical anti-commutation relationships. And what it is to be an electron is to be representable in this way, to have states that live in this kind of state space that, to which pertain magnitudes understood in this way, where these magnitudes are functionally entangled in a peculiar way. What is a thing? Well, a physical theory tells you what a thing is by assigning it a pile of states of state space, but it's not just a pile, it's not undifferentiated. The states are individuated, characterized by physical magnitudes they instantiate. And those physical magnitudes themselves aren't a pile, they're also structured, dynamic, and functional relationships, often characteristic of the theory question, which is a decision for theory in question. So this is a am I talking too fast, John? Mm-hmm. Okay. Restating more directly what I just said. Physical theory gives you a concept of kind of objects it's about. I'm going to pretend that concept takes the form of what I'm going to call a kinematic pair. The first element of the kinematic pair are the magnitudes that pertain to the object and their structure, kind of laws they obey. The second element of the pair, collection of states possible. Give me that. You give me a lot about what it is to be that kind of object. Okay. The sort of interesting thing happens, when you take quantum statistical mechanics to the thermodynamic limit is the concept of object afforded by the theories in quantum change. For quantum statistical mechanics, for finite many systems, that's one account of what it is to be a quantum system. For quantum statistical mechanics for infinitely many systems, there's a different kind of account of what it is to be a physical system. There's no kind of kinematic pair. I'm going to rehearse in more detail how it is a quantum theory generates a token of the type of concept of object I say physical theories use. At this point, I could have appealed to authority and cited numerous mathematical physicists saying things to the effect that to specify a quantum theory is to specify a set of commutation or anti-commutation relations. There's a set of laws and that small set of important magnitudes have to obey. So I'm going to take that as a working hypothesis. We individuate theories, we specify theories by specifying their canonical commutation or anti-commutation relations. It's extremely and tragically faint, but if you're talking about, say, a single spin one-half system, like an electron, the constitutive canonical relations are these things called the Pauli relations, which if you know what commutators are, you know what those are. If you don't, all that matters is you're legislating away some important magnitudes have to stand to one another in order to be magnitudes pertaining to an electron. Okay. But you can't stop there if you're just going to be doing physics. Right. The guys involved in the canonical anti-commutation relations correspond to spin along three rectilinear axes. And you might be interested in spins in other directions. You need better than you do physics with these things. But nicely, the way you sort of generate the other magnitudes you're interested in, or there's a way to generate the other magnitudes you're interested in. And it's just to build them up from the canonical magnitudes, the magnitudes satisfying the anti-commutation relations. So here's the recipe. I can do some relations. I say what it is to be a spin system is to satisfy these relations. You find the kind of state space typical of a quantum system, the Hilbert space. You find a bunch of guys, operators, representatives of magnitudes acting on that system to satisfy the canonical relations. This is called, this explains a pun in my title, so I'm going to belabor it, a representation of the canonical anti-commutation relations. And then you start building up other magnitudes by adding together, multiplying, taking linear combinations of the canonical magnitudes. And if you are diligent enough, the result is going to be, this is just notation, but I'll tell you what it is. It's all the operators on the state space you started with, the full set of bounded operators on the Hilbert space you started with. That's going to be your collection of magnitudes, the first entry in the kinematic pair. Okay, so you started with some basic magnitudes, their structure, understood constitution of the theory, you built up a bunch of other magnitudes. That's going to be your collection of magnitudes. The next thing you do is you supply a same story of what it is to be a state of a system, the kind of system to which these magnitudes pertain. And the same story usually takes states to say this element of this collection of magnitudes that corresponds to certain propositions, it's probability one. require states to be linear, it requires states to be commonly additive. There's reasons that these are all just nice features of states. So once you generate your set of magnitudes from your representation of the canonical relations and appended a story about what kinds of states are same, you've gotten a kinematic pair. You've gotten a concept of object according to this quantum theory. And I'm going to claim without defense that as long as, subscript n, as long as you're dealing with quantum statistical mechanics with finitely many systems, it doesn't matter whether they're mechanical commutation relations kind of systems or spin systems. As long as you're focusing your attention to quantum statistical mechanics with finitely many systems, the sort of kinematic pair you're going to get is going to be of a single sort. It's going to be of this sort. The magnitudes will be the full set of bounded operators, or the self-adjoint elements of the full set of bounded operators, the space of states, the full set of states, mixed states as well as pure states, correspond to density matrices on the Hilbert space. If the notations are familiar, don't sweat it. The point is, we started with these canonical anti-commutation relations. We took a bunch of magnitudes that satisfied them, we built more magnitudes out of them, and then we threw in all the states that made sense, the states on that one. And the kinematic pair we get is a kinematic pair of that form. Duration of time, there's an argument reinforcing that this is the right way to be about things, or not. Skip over time. Okay. So far, the idea of physical theory, it's got a way of telling you what kinds of objects it treats of. That way is by way of giving you these kinematic pairs. All quantum system mechanics, finitely many systems, gives you a kinematic pair of the same sort. And so the question of whether something one version of the question of whether something interesting happens when you get the thermodynamic limit is whether the concept of object afforded by quantum statistical mechanics changes. Whether when you go through the exercise of trying to equip the thermodynamic limit of quantum statistical mechanics with a kinematic pair, you get a kinematic pair, the sort that's generic to quantum statistical mechanics for finitely many systems. That's the question. To answer this question using the example of a system at the thermodynamic limit, an infinite chain of electrons, an infinite spin chain. Here's how we're going to put it together. We have an infinite one-dimensional array. We're going to index it by the positive and negative integers, so we're going to have set 0 at the center, just for convenience, and sites going all the way to minus infinity, and the other direction, sites going all the way to infinity. It's going to be an electron in each site. And we're going to make a quantum theory of the system in a totally normal way. We're going to start with the canonical anti-commutation relations that are supposedly constitutive of quantum theories. They're just the canonical anti-commutation relations for a single spin system with the requirement that magnitudes pertaining to different sites don't really care about each other. And then we're going to see whether, as in the case of quantum statistical mechanics for finitely many systems, a unique kind of kinematic pair is fixed by specifying the canonical anti-commutation relation, and whether that unique kind of kinematic pair is the kind, the ordinary, sorry, the QSM for finitely many systems sort. I'm going to show you that when you go through the construction procedure in the case of the thermodynamic limit, you come across a question of principle, a question that's critical to answer, that doesn't emerge in the case where you're considering only finitely many systems. So I'm going to try to indicate what that question is, what possible strategies there are for answering it, what considerations might speak for or against one strategy rather than another. So we've been talking about magnetization. Magnetization, the kind of magnetization we care about in the ferromagnet, you can just think of it as the average magnetic field due to the electrons in the infinite spin chain. Physically, it'll be more complicated than that, but it's the same idea. So we're interested in doing physics. We're interested in starting with our canonical magnitudes and building up other wage-earning magnitudes in explanation prediction with. So let's start with this magnitude and calling it magnetization in the z direction for n elements of the chain, or for a finite part of the chain. what this magnitude is, as I've defined it, is the average over a set of sites centered at zero and extending n places in either direction of their spin in the z direction. Spin generates magnetic fields. And the idea is, if all the spins are lined up, then there's going to be a real strong magnetic field associated with that chunk of the terrain. Whereas if they sort of are randomized, they're going to cancel each other out. And a way to gauge the strength of the magnetic field associated with that chunk of the chain centered at zero is to just take the average of spin in the z direction. It's a perfectly good observable, important observable. You can imagine what you want to do with an observable like that. And it's an absolutely innocent observable. No problem of using observable for magnitude, because I've read too much about quantum mechanics. By observable, I just mean physical magnitude. There's absolutely no problem about whether this magnitude has a right to join our theory, because it's just a linear combination of magnitudes that join our theory automatically in virtue of being among the magnitudes that provide a representation of fundamental anti-commutation relations. Perfectly good, unproblematic magnitude. But suppose we're interested in this infinite spin chain in bulk, in aggregate, as a unit. What are we to make of its total magnetization, its global magnetization? I just defended that there's a principled way to associate a magnetization of any finite chunk of the chain, it's not equal to zero. Is there a way to associate a magnetization in total with the whole chain? It might seem simple enough to do that. The magnetization of the whole chain, you might say, is just the n goes to infinity limit of the finite string magnetizations. Just take the magnetization for ever growing subsequences of the chain centered at zero. It's totally reasonable. But here's the question. Define the magnetization of the whole chain as this infinite limit, this n goes to infinity limit of this linear combination of spins at each site. Here's the novel question. The question you don't run into when you're doing quantum mechanics for only finitely many systems. The question you don't run into until the thermodynamic limit. What do we make of this limit? How do we understand this limit? What is it to take this limit? The reason is that we know perfectly well what limits of sequences of numbers are, and we do what we can reconstruct what we were told in 10th grade about it. But the catch here is this thing on the Earth that would define the global magnetization, isn't a limit of sequence of numbers. It's a limit of sequence of these guys operators acting on Hilbert spaces. So we need some story of what it is for a sequence of Hilbert space operators to have a limit, to know what it is we will partly be talking about when we talk about the magnetization of a whole chain. Now this slide is going to get a little heavy with details. The important thing is the gratifying fact. Don't sweat the details if you're not into that kind of thing. Just try to hang on to the gratifying fact. There's a variety of ways this slide, transparency represents only a meager subset of them, to make sense of the notion of a limit of a sequence of operators on a Hilbert space. Here are two of them. One's something like the uniform operator topology, another is something like the weak operator topology. Each of them can be defined with respect to a set of pure states, a set of states for which something is certain on the Hilbert space. So let's capital phi be your collection of pure states. Here's how you decide, using the uniform operator topology, whether a sequence of operators A sub n converges to an operator A n. You move out of the sequence. And at each step n, you take a vote. And this is what the vote's about. You pull each pure state in the Hilbert space about how big the difference is between the nth element of the sequence and its putative limit. And you keep track of the biggest answer you get. Now the sequence of operators A sub n converges to the operator n just in case. Just in case, as you repeat this polling process, each state, at each step, asking all the pure states, how big is this, and keeping the largest answer. In case the largest answer goes away, goes to zero. That's uniform operator convergence. The weak operator topology has a slightly different rule for deciding when a sequence of operators A sub n converges to an operator A. It's a slightly different rule. It also makes use of a full set of pure states. But rather than holding them at each stage all together, what the weak operator topology does is it goes through the pure states one by one. And if it's the case that for each pure state, according to that pure state, the difference between the nth element of the sequence and its putative limit goes away, then the sequence converges to its putative limit. The uniform operator topology is called the uniform criterion of convergence. The weak operator topology is called a pointwise criterion of convergence. Okay, if you like that, that's great. If you didn't, I'm sorry about it. Here's the point. The question we need in order to make sense of global magnetization to decide what it is for a sequence of operators on Hilbert space to converge. There's different answers you might give, and the answers are really different. That is, in the case that your Hilbert space is infinite dimensional, the answers are really different. If Hilbert space is infinite dimensional, there can be sequences of operators in the set of operators on the Hilbert space that converge weakly but not uniformly. The most notorious and upsetting example is if you have a countable set of pairwise orthogonal projection operators, the sequence of partial sums of those guys converges weakly but not uniformly. This is the important thing. Depending on what answer you give to the question, what is it for a sequence of these things to converge? Depending on what topology you use, you can make different calls about which sequence to converge. Now here's the cash value of that, or one way I see the cash value of that. This is, how much of the time have I been standing?
You can just keep going, don't worry about it.
I used to wear white shirts because I knew I'd do it, but I forgot to. So back to our infinite spin chain. And this example, except for the Mr. Ed part of it, is set out very clearly in books by Sewell. Remember the constitutive identifying, launching relation between physical magnitudes that supposedly individuates the theory of the infinite spin chain or the canonical commutation relations. And so if you're a physicist who's supposed to build a theory of the infinite spin chain, your job is to go out and find the Hilbert space representation of a canonical anti-commutation. Okay. So here's some ways I might do it. Here's how Paul did it. His Hilbert space, you can think of as like this. It's got one sort of central, important, most important vector. It's a vector that assigns each site in the infinite spin chain an electron spinning in the positive z direction. That's one of the basis vectors for the Hilbert space. The remaining basis vectors for the Hilbert space and Paul's Hilbert space representation can be obtained from this basic one by finitely many spin flips. So every basis vector in Paul's Hilbert space is going to have infinitely many up guys and finitely many down guys. We want to get zero. And there's a nice, sort of straightforward, easy way for him to build a representation of the canonical anti-commutation relations on that Hilbert space. And then you can go to town. You can start making linear combinations of the representatives and so on and so on. Okay, Mary's contrary. She also goes and finds the Hilbert space representation of the canonical anti-commutation relations. And you think of Mary's as Paul's flipped over. So whereas Paul's representation sort of emanated from the basis vector where all the spins were up, Mary's emanates from the basis vector where all the spins are down. And the other basis vectors in the Hilbert space are basis vectors that differ from, they're all down and only find them in many places. So for every basis vector in Mary's Hilbert space, there's infinitely many spin downs, finally many spin ups. And if she can, again, find a nice worked out representation of canonical anti-commutation relations on that Hilbert space. And then the physicist Mr. Ed, he's got to be different because he's a horse. Here's how he makes a representation of the canonical anti-commutation relations for the infinite spin chain. Because he's a horse, he's very good at keeping track of things. So instead of having a very simple translationally invariant basis vector, his basis vector, he's got a guy up the center, then two guys down in each stock, four guys up, then he goes down. Maybe you'll see what's going to happen if he's going to haze in this way. And then the other basis vectors in his Hilbert space are going to differ from his sort of basic basis vector in finite many places. And just like Paul and Mary, there's a way for Mr. Ed to represent the canonical anti-commutation relations on his Hilbert space. Now remember what's going on here. We're inquiring about the thermodynamic limit, whether, as in the case of quantum statistical mechanics for finitely many systems, to say, here are the anti-commutation relations that determines your theory. And we've encountered a certain issue. We're going to want at the thermodynamic limit to make a judgment call about which limits of sequences of canonical operators range only physical magnitudes. And I've introduced two ways to guide our judgment, two criteria of convergence for operators on Hilbert space. One's the weak operator topology, one's the uniform operator topology. Names don't matter. What matters, I guess, is an example, are the following facts. Remember, I put this subliminally here, and you can't see. Remember, this is the finite chain magnetization whose end goes to infinity limit would define the magnetization of the whole chain. Here are the facts. That thing doesn't have a uniform limit in anybody's Hilbert space. That thing just doesn't converge uniformly. However, in Paul's Hilbert space, it converges weakly. It converges weakly to a very interesting operator. It converges weakly to the identity of the operator that every state's an identity, the identity operator. For Mary, and maybe this isn't surprising given what I just said about Paul, that sequence of partial sums, it also converges in her Hilbert space, but this time it converges to minus one times the identity operator. For Mr. Ed, it doesn't even converge weakly. Then I would oscillate wildly as you go out farther and farther and farther. Okay. With these facts in mind, a particular version of the novel question I say you encounter when you're trying to build up a quantum theory of the thermodynamic limit is global polarization, is the n goes to infinity average of the finite chain polarization, is that a physical magnitude or not? We all see this as a very way of putting the question. The variant way is which sorts of limits of sequences of magnitudes are also magnitudes? Are we going to count only uniform limits, also weak limits, some other strategy? And now the claim I want to try to defend that underwrites my further claim, which sort of interesting happens when you deal with the thermodynamic limit, is that there are good answers to this question that equip quantum statistical mechanics at the thermodynamic limit with an account of what it is to be a quantum system different from the account afforded by finite quantum statistical mechanics. A different concept of object gets constituted at the thermodynamic limit. Yeah, now here's one kind of answer you might give to the novel question, which limits of sequences of magnitudes are also magnitudes. You might say, only uniform limits. Let's adopt the criterion of convergence according to which it's hardest to converge. One virtue of that is everyone, all the physicists, and I should have said they were all perfectly competent physicists. They all did exactly what I told them to do. They all went out and found a representation of the canonical line of commutation was going to give this big chain. If the answer you give is only uniform limits, they all agree about what the magnitudes are. That seems like some sort of virtue that all competent people agree what the answer to the question is. And the kind of object that contains the physical magnitudes they all agree exist is something called the C-star algebra. That doesn't matter. What matters is, compared to the collection of magnitudes you get if you're following the ordinary quantum statistical mechanics for finitely many systems recipe, the collection of magnitudes you obtain by taking only uniform limits is strictly smaller. One way of putting it is imagine your Paul. If you're Paul and you're doing ordinary quantum statistical mechanics for finite many systems, you're going to say the magnitudes of all the operators on your Hilbert space. Well, if Paul follows the take only uniform limits recipe, the collection of magnitudes is going to recognize this physical proper subset. So what we purchase by having everybody agree is we, in some sense, impoverish our collection of magnitudes. And unsurprisingly, having identified our magnitudes, the next step of a constitution of the concept of object according to physical theory is to describe what states and those magnitudes admit. There's a corresponding expansion in the set of states. What it is to be a sane state with respect to this collection of magnitudes is provided by the notion of a normed positive linear functional on that collection of magnitudes. So there's a criterion that was applicable in the case of finite quantum statistical mechanics that drops away the criterion of countable additivity as a result of there's fewer criteria a state has to settle. There's fewer criteria a state has to satisfy, there's more states. There's states on the small algebra, small collection of observables that aren't in Paul's ordinary quantum statistical mechanics collecting those states. Which seems pretty exciting for my overarching thesis. If you take the answer the way we settle the novel question, which limits count, take the answer everybody agrees to, you wind up with a kinematic pair different in kind from the kinematic pair from the way you organized statistical mechanics. You wind up intuitively with fewer magnitudes, more states. However, this is really a common answer. And the reason this answer one, take the uniform limits, is a cruddy answer, you're going to mention statistical mechanics, thermodynamics, something. I'm going to mention physics for the first time. Let's keep in mind that while we might bother going to the thermodynamic limit at all, what we're trying to do with these theories. One thing we might try to do with these theories is understand ferromagnetism, this famous propensity of iron bars to, below certain critical temperatures, sustain a net magnetization. So that physicists who are unwise enough to wear iron glasses have them sucked off their faces. And I'm going to, this is uncontroversial, but I'm going to work with the assumption that when we're trying to come to terms with ferromagnetism, our target explanandum is going to be the existence at these critical temperatures of multiple distinct equilibrium states. A paramagnetic equilibrium state that assigns zero net magnetization, and a variety of different ferromagnetic equilibrium states, one where the magnetic field sucks my glasses off that way, the other way the magnetic field tracks them further. This is phase structure. This is a characteristic feature of thermodynamic systems. At certain critical temperatures, some of them emit multiple distinct equilibrium states. And now we can see why I think answer one is a cruddy answer. Remember, I should have mentioned this, might have been on the slide. Remember I said if you take answer one, take only uniform limits, use the cautious criterion of convergence, you're going to wind up with fewer magnitudes than you would otherwise, than you would if the thermodynamic limit cleaved to the model afforded by quantum system mechanics or finite unary systems. Well, one of the magnitudes that gets left out is magnetization. Is global magnetization. Because remember, for nobody did MN converge as an N to infinity. That's one of the magnitudes that's going to get left out. So one problem with respect to this explanatory aim of adopting answer that no one can agree to is it disables the explanatory aim by disenfranchising the very magnitude, global magnetization, that you use to distinguish between distinct equilibrium states. Maybe a story about the physics of the system everybody can agree to, but they can't do what they want with it. They can't say paramagnetic phase differs from ferromagnetic phase and having zero net magnetization because they're not allowed magnetization as an observer. Okay, so the loser answer, let's try again. A novel question, what limits the sequences of magnitudes are also magnitudes? Let's try weak ones. Given the catalog of options I set up, that's our only other possibility. So let's imagine Mary building a theory. She starts with the canonical anti-commutation relations. She finds a representation of them. She takes all possible linear combinations of the guys in the representation, and she throws in the weak limit ones. This is the new thing she can do now, because we're saying admit weak limits as limits. What Mary's going to wind up with, as her collection of physical magnitudes, is the full set of bounded operators on her Hilbert space. Consider this structured by the canonical anti-commutation relations. That's what that subscript or whatever it is keeps meaning. And if Mary requires her states to be sane in the relevant sense, Mary's going to wind up with the kinematic pair afforded by her full set of bounded operators and all the density operators. That is, she's going to wind up with the kinematic pair, a concept of object, a count of what a thing is, of exactly the sort one encounters for quantum statistical mechanics or quantum unary systems. Kind of looks like if you take the weak limit answer, wind up where we started. In fact, my exciting thesis collapses. If the weak limit answer, you just reconstitute the notion of what a quantum system is converted from or made of quantum system mechanics. But here's a complication. I told you what happened when Mary employed the answer. Count weak limits, not just uniform limits, but also weak limits. What happens when Paul does? Well, when Paul takes weak limits, he winds up with the kinematic pair of an ordinary QM-ish sort that consists of the bounded operators on his Hilbert space and the density operators on his Hilbert space. And now we've got Mary's kinematic pair, we've got Paul's kinematic pair, and we can ask the question, these guys started from the same canonical anti-commutation relations. Canonical anti-commutation relations are supposed to individuate theories. These guys should wind up with the same theory. We can ask the question, is Mary's kinematic pair and Paul's kinematic pair, if I found it in the right order, are those physically equivalent? And there's, I can say more about this in my 2 minutes.
You can take a little time.
But there's
you can take at least some time.
There's a robust, venerable, very sensible notion of what it is the quantum theory is delivered in this form to be physically equivalent, provided by the notion of unitary equivalence. And according to this criterion of physical equivalence afforded by unitary equivalence, Paul's theory is different from Mary's theory. They're physically different. A symptom of this, if you think about it, according to Paul, Paul says, here are the physical possibilities. Let's just think of the physical possibilities with respect to the magnetization of something. The only kinds of states that are physically possible for the system are states in which the magnetization is one in the up direction. That follows from how we set up this Hilbert space. That's his account of what's physically possible. Mary's account of what's physically possible is totally similar but different in detail. For Mary, there's only one kind of state with respect to magnetization that's typically possible. And that's a state where the magnetization is down. This is a pretty striking symptom of the physical equivalence, inequivalence of their theories. Paul says only states of positive magnetization are possible. Mary says only states of negative magnetization are possible. They disagree about which things are possible. So a pretty clear way for two physical theories to disagree about what the possibilities are. It's a symptom of unitary inequivalence as well. So here's the difference between quantum statistical mechanics for finitely many systems and quantum statistical mechanics for infinitely many systems. When you're dealing with finitely many systems, once you have your canonical relations, any representation, any kinematic pair generated by any representation you find of them is going to be physically equivalent according to this criterion of physical equivalence to any other. The sort of thing that just happened to Paul and Mary for n equals infinity, n has to equal infinity for that to happen. It doesn't happen when it's finite. You can always find a translation manual between finite theories that reveals them to be the same. For quantum statistical mechanics of the thermodynamic, this is not so. And so, I'm suggesting, even if quantum statistical mechanics of the thermodynamic limit uses kinematic pairs of the sort we encounter for finitely many statistical systems, in order to sort of specify the theory, you need an additional ingredient. You need something in addition to the canonical anti-commutation relations. The additional ingredient you need is something like when you concoct your set of observables by adding weak limit points to the collection of observables providing a representation of the canonical relations. Weak limits according to who? Paul, to Mary, to Mr. Ed. This is like my second to last slide. Oh, no, it's not
the
last slide.
That's fine, take
the time. Okay. Here's a further complication with thinking with the second answer, add weak limit points. One complication is it's not a complete answer because in addition to saying build your theory by adding weak limit points, you have to say according to who, weak limit points according to who. Another complication is, at least in the form we've encountered it, it's also a Cardan answer. So suppose we let Mary identify the weak limit points. Then she's going to say, these are the magnitudes, these are the states, here's my iron bar here, I'm reminding you against the Bloomingly of my explanatory aspiration to recognize multiple equilibrium states distinguished by the values they assign of phases of a global magnetization. Well, for Mary, the good news is she's got a global magnetization observable. That's one of the things she picked up by allowing weak limits into her collection of observables. The bad news for Mary is according to her, the only possible states are states in which the magnetization is minus one. So she's got the magnitude that would distinguish between distinct equilibrium states, but she doesn't have the distinct equilibrium states to distinguish. So the Paul, weak limits according to Paul, weak limits according to Mary, neither of those are good answers. And yeah, this is, I mean, it's going to hand wave you so far, this is going to be even more hand wave. The answer is take weak limits, favor, select your favored few. Mr. Ed, he's now favored, and demented about Mr. Ed, Paul, Mary, your favor. And let them answer, and then paste their answers together. So you start with Mary's representation and Paul's representation, and you build something called the direct sum of those representations. If you know what the details are, you can concoct them, otherwise it don't matter. Don't worry. And then because we're using the answer of weak limits, but according to a few, you add the weak limit points. And you're going to get something that's kind of like this. Your collection of observables is going to be something like Mary's collection pasted together with Paul's collection. It's going to include Mary's magnetization pasted together with Paul's magnetization, which we're just going to call magnetization, period. It's not going to be the same set of observables as you get by taking the full set of bounded operators on any Hilbert space. That's going to be your set of observables, and then you do your usual thing. You recognize the states, the ones that behave sanely on that set of observables. Recognizing the states, the ones that behave sanely on that set of observables, you're going to recognize states such that the magnetization is plus one, states such that it's minus one. And something else really interesting happens. Every pure state in your collection of states is going to be an eigenstate of the magnetization. This doesn't happen in ordinary quantum statistical mechanics. The only observables in ordinary quantum statistical mechanics of which every pure state is an eigenstate are the identity observables. Now we're getting observables seems physically different from the identity observable, magnetization. It is different from the identity observable. It takes different values, plus one, minus one. But yet every pure state is an eigenstate. State that assigns probability 1 to a predetermined value. It's a better answer. It's a bit more complicated. But I think it's pretty good. You get what you need according to our explanatory aspiration. You get multiple distinct equilibrium states and a wage earning observable that distinguishes between them. What more could you ask for? I just said it. Pretty good answer, the pasting together answer. So let's say that for the concept of object. It seems like a good candidate for the concept of object afforded by quantum system mechanics and the thermodynamic limit. And maybe I'll end here. If that's so, it seems that the concept of object has mutated from the concept of object familiar from quantum statistical mechanics for finite limit systems. There, you give me canonical relations that generates the rest. There's an easy way to do it. And the rest takes the form of a collection of bounded operators, a collection of density operators from a fixed separable Hilbert space. In the thermodynamic limit, you got to add this extra ingredient. Who are the favorite few? Who am I pulling? It'd be nice if you gave some reason for throwing Mr. Red out, other than Homo sapiens centrism. Although this seems sort of less of a good introduce, and when you follow the recipe, the structure of the set of observables and the structure of the set of states is not isomorphic to the structures typical from ordinary QM, from quantum mechanics systems. So what my conclusions are, I'd say what seems kind of exciting about them to me, getting the type of the kinematic pair quantum theory offers you changes when you're doing a thermodynamic work. That's sort of interesting. It's sort of interesting in a way that deserves to be tagged with words like emergence. I leave that to people who know how to use those words. In particular, to me, the interesting part of the change is that the content of the theory, quantum system, has a thermodynamic limit. That is, what observables you take to be physical, what states you take to be possible. It's contoured by privileging the selection strategies. Who do you pull and why? And that leaves open a possibility that's kind of my hobby horse, that a different explanatory, predictive, practical, theory-building, modeling circumstances, they might motivate different selection criteria. So if there's a selection criteria essential to specifying the content of a theory of these kinds, and if the selection criteria that are appropriate or context-specific, then the content of a theory of these kinds might change from context to context to context.
It's the anti-penultimate.
So the picture This only suggests, in the sense of makes some possibility space for. You got these things that are laws of theory, but as they are refracted through the prism of what theories do, you wind up with different accounts of what the content of theory is. And this is just a throwaway last question I can't possibly defend. But is phase structure emergent, or does it simply illustrate latent representational resources quantum theories have all along?